Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Throughout this series, created in partnership with Coutts, I will be speaking to senior experts, thought leaders, and influencers from the world of travel, architecture, investment, consumer goods, and more, as we examine how we can embed purpose and sustainability into our everyday lives. From responsible investment to electric vehicles to eco-conservation, we'll explore the new technology, partnerships, and initiatives helping all of us to lead cleaner and greener lives. My guest today is the writer, broadcaster, and best-selling author, Afua Hirsch. Formerly a barrister, Afua regularly writes, reports, and speaks on international current affairs, grappling with subjects including race, class, and gender. She has published two best-selling books, British, on Race, Identity, and Belonging, winner of the Royal Society of Literature Gerwood Prize, and Equal to Everything about the UK Supreme Court. Her current projects include a six-part series with Samuel L. Jackson, a major BBC series about African art, which is out now. Afua was a judge on last year's Booker Prize and is currently the Wallace Annenberg Chair of Journalism at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. She is one half of the fashion brand Seeker, which creates ethically made, sustainable, African-inspired clothing made in Ghana and sold globally. Welcome, Afua.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to see you.
Likewise. So I want to ask you questions around launching a fashion brand. You are a polymath. You do so many different things that I can scarcely believe you can even fit the arduous world of fashion in your schedule. So what inspired you to move into the fashion industry and to start a fashion line, a collaboration with Phyllis Taylor, who is the creative director of Seeker?
Well, it's interesting to hear that question coming from you, Paul, because I don't think I've ever met anyone who has so many overlapping areas of passion as we do, as also a lawyer and somebody with multiple projects and with your role in fashion and ethical fashion and African fashion. So I think you won't be surprised to hear that actually kind of venturing into fashion came very naturally for me, and actually was probably the most effortless thing I've done in a sense, because I've always loved fashion. And when I transitioned from being a print journalist to a TV journalist, it became more than just something that I did in my spare time. Thinking about the way I presented myself and what I wore became a statement of my values. And I suddenly had this visual platform being on TV. And I started to think more intentionally about the way I dressed. And I realized that the clothes that I was buying and wearing on air represented brands that I was marketing, essentially. You know, with my own money, I was investing in publicizing these brands, and it made me have to think much more deeply about what these brands stood for and whether I wanted to promote them and align my own values with theirs. And I started to really question the ways in which I bought clothes just because they seemed like an appropriate thing to wear on TV. And I really wanted to, I suppose, achieve two things. I wanted to dress in a way that I felt reflected my identity and my creativity as a person. And that's something I've always done in my spare time. But now I wanted to do that on screen because I felt like it would help communicate my message in an aesthetic way. And I also wanted to be promoting a brand that shared my values. So I started talking to Seeker, which is a brand that I've supported for a long time. As you mentioned, it was started by Phyllis Taylor in 2004. I've bought Seeker clothes for a long time. I've known Phyllis. I love the ethos of the business. Seeker means abundance in Chi, which is the language both our families, our Ghanaian families, speak. And from its inception, it's been an ethical brand. It's been made in Ghana. It's had the craftspeople and the tailors who make the clothes at the heart of the brand. But the problem I had with a lot of African fashion is that it was difficult for me to wear on TV, if I'm honest, because very bright, voluminous prints are so different from what's conventional in the current affairs TV world that it risked making too much of a statement. You know, I wasn't trying to steal the show with my clothes. I just wanted to reflect who I was. So Phyllis and I started talking about designing collections that would be true to the spirit of an African brand, but also blend seamlessly into the professional world in the kinds of places where modern professional women work, whether that's New York or London or Lagos or Accra. And I designed a capsule collection with Phyllis. That was back in 2017, and the rest is history. Since then, we've collaborated on everything. I'm now part of Seeker. And it's been an absolutely joyful thing to do, to feel like I now am able to create the visions that I've had, to work with the incredible team that Seeker put together and has been supporting over years, and to allow other men and women to buy our clothes, because there's just been this demand. And I suppose what I've learned, which shouldn't be surprising, is that if I felt that I needed something that didn't exist, there were other people who were also looking for it. So it's been a really positive story.
So Seeker pieces are made ethically in Ghana. And having been involved in this myself, I know there are a plethora of challenges of launching an ethical fashion brand. So give us a sense, just catalog some of the both delights and the difficulties of doing so.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that for me, the first ethical principle is simply manufacturing in an African country, because African economies have been totally dependent on resource extraction. It's the colonial model that was set up that is still very much a reality. Raw goods get taken out, very little value gets added in country, it creates few jobs. It doesn't help the economy sustain and support infrastructure development. And I, having been a journalist on the African continent, having worked in development before, having traveled very widely around West Africa, which is the part of the African continent I know best, was really passionate about the need for people who feel a connection to these countries to find a way to invest in manufacturing, to break that cycle of resources leaving and the income and the infrastructure not being created domestically. So it's, I think, an important and powerful symbol simply to create manufacturing in an African country like Ghana. It's also difficult, and there's a reason why a lot of people don't do it. You know, it is a vicious cycle. The power is unreliable. If you're running a factory or any kind of plant in Ghana, you have to be able to use your own power when the grid fails. That is very difficult to do in an environmentally friendly way. It's also very expensive. There isn't a universal healthcare system. That means that for a small business, you need to make sure that you're taking care of the healthcare needs of your employees. That can be expensive and complicated. And, you know, a country that doesn't have the kind of welfare state or some of the other infrastructures that we have in Britain, for example, frequently creates challenges, and the roads are unreliable. It's difficult to get from one part of Ghana to another part of Ghana. The colonial model created a system where everything is extracted to the coast. All roads lead to the coast. So these are some of the basic challenges that everyone who manufactures in Ghana experiences. How to therefore manufacture in a country like Ghana and do so in a way where you're not just meeting the bottom line, but doing more, going above and beyond, really supporting and investing in the people who work for you, nurturing their talent, upskilling them so that they can then have a better life for themselves, is something that requires just a huge amount of personal commitment. And I honestly don't think anyone other than Phyllis would have had the endurance and tenacity to do that. She founded it in 2004, so that's now 16 years of really taking care of the business and the people who work for the business. And I think that's at the heart of Seeker, is that we're totally hands-on. Everything we make is done in-house with people who work for us, who we pay a fair wage, who we look after. And that's work. It's labor intensive, it's difficult to scale. And these are some of the challenges that, to be very honest, we grapple with every day in our business.
So you alluded to in your kind of opening kind of both dilemma and rationale and motivation for being involved in Seeker, wanting to be supportive of both an African tradition and an African aesthetic. And also, I presume, wanting to innovate, develop something which has a modern eye, something which, you know, a London-based barrister, journalist, writer, critic, public intellectual, you know, name the list, would feel comfortable wearing. Where do you see that kind of balance and tension from an aesthetic perspective in seeking to accomplish both of those things? How do you get that right?
I think that tradition versus innovation is really the beating heart. It's the kind of tension that drives Seeker, because the reason that I love African fashion is that I'm passionate about the history. You know, I voraciously consume the history, the heritage. So many of our prints have really deep embedded meanings, whether it's from the independence movement, symbols of liberation or education. One of my favorite Ghanaian prints is actually a pencil. And when you look at it closely, it's lots and lots of pencils and different colors. And that comes from Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana's drive for universal education for Ghana for the first time. So many of these prints have these histories. They're, in a way, they are part of our literary canon in Ghana. And I love that. I'm also fascinated by the craft itself, the way in which traditional fabrics like kente, which is the traditional Ashanti weaving technique, or batik, as you can see I'm wearing now. I mean, our listeners can't see, but I'm wearing one of our batik shirts right now. And all our batiks are still printed in the traditional way. And the reason that we commission our own batiks, we have them made in a bespoke way for Seeker using the traditional craft, is that we want to keep that craft alive, you know. And the marketplace in African countries is now being flooded with lots of cheap imitation goods from China and other countries, which is threatening to destroy the heritage of the craftspeople who have been doing this for centuries. So we want to preserve the integrity of the craft and the spirit of African fashion that has influenced the world. So many people have taken and been inspired from African prints, but the practices themselves are dying, and that's something that we really wanted to help challenge. But also, I think, like so many people, you know, my identity is hyphenated and complicated. I see myself very much as a feminist, as a modern professional woman. I like to break barriers in my work. I'm not afraid to be versatile. But at the same time, much of my sense of identity is rooted in the African continent, in our history and culture. And the way I dress is a way of expressing that duality, that multiplicity. So how we can take those traditions and update them, be creative with them, pair them with other fabrics, cut them in interesting ways. You know, lately we've had lots of asymmetric designs. We've been using cutouts. We've been experimenting with volume, with pleats, all of the things that, you know, have been kind of being innovated in seasons in the fashion world. We want to incorporate our tradition in interpreting them in a new way. And I think, you know, a lot of it is just us experimenting. And it's so incredibly energizing to see the reception that we've had, that so many people are and people not just of African heritage, people from all over the world, different races, different nationalities and perspectives and faiths, have just been excited by that innovation. And I think that not just us, lots of African designers are really at the forefront of kind of avant-garde and creative fashion at the moment. And I think that's extremely exciting to see.
So I want to ask you a question about brand, because brand is about promise, it's about storytelling, it's about mythology. And I've always thought that you should never ask human beings to choose between ethics and desire, because they will always choose desire. And when you're trying to build an ethical fashion brand, what you then have to do is try and make what's ethical desirable. And tell us how you've gone about doing that, how you've gone about telling the story of the good you do, the giving back, the contribution to the continent, but also fashion is about desire. And you want to be able to neither withdraw from nor apologize from desire, but you want to try and marry ethics and desire in an interesting way. It seems as though you've succeeded, but how did you achieve that alchemy?
By necessity. Seeker, from its inception, has always been an ethical brand, and it's always been a made-to-order brand. It's always had a price point that reflects the fact that everything is handmade by our craftspeople. That has been reflected in the price, in the time it takes from order to receiving our clothes. And when Phyllis first started Seeker, it was very difficult to communicate to people who, this was the era of fast fashion really mushrooming. People wanted stuff immediately. They wanted it to be cheap. And having to communicate to people that we don't employ children, we don't pay people below a fair wage, we're not willing to cut those corners. And we don't see that as optional. You know, we didn't see this as ethical fashion. We saw this as how fashion should be. This is how people should work. This is how people should live. This is the story that should be behind the clothes that you wear. And I think we're not afraid of being unequivocal about that. But it has been harder at times to communicate that or to really get people to buy into that. And it's been surprising how people in other areas of their life espouse certain values and ethics have kind of had a blind spot when it comes to fashion. And so I think in a way, the culture has now caught up with where we've been at, that now there is this narrative around why it matters to buy ethical fashion, around slow fashion, around caring about the process as well as the product. So in a way, that's helped us because we were doing that before it was a thing. And that meant that we had to tell the story. There was no option. People would not be willing to pay more for something that takes longer if we didn't explain to them and communicate why this matters, why it's unique, why it's keeping things that we should all value alive, why the item of clothing that you'll be wearing is special and represents something and tells a story and means something different to you. So we had to just, for survival's sake, work out how to communicate that. And actually now it just feels as if things are changing around us and that's becoming a much easier story to tell. And actually now it's kind of how to keep the uniqueness of that, because we were doing it when others weren't. And now everyone says they're doing that. But we know that it's absolutely at the core of what our brand is about.
So there's something very reassuring, but also very troubling when people start imitating you, because you know that's the highest form of flattery. But on another level, there's always that sense that it's kind of greenwashing or whitewashing in these particular instances. So when it comes to sustainable and social justice practices, do you think it matters what the core motivation of the creative directors and the founders are of these brands? Or do you think we should just celebrate the fact that the mainstream industry, for whatever reason, is kind of moving towards a more ethical reflex?
I mean, I slightly push back against the dichotomy. I think it's good when cultures change and mores change, norms change. That's positive. It means that the company that wants to be unethical is going to find it harder to explain to its shareholders or its customers or its regulators why it's functioning that way. And that's good for everyone. But at the same time, I think you're right. If you are greenwashing or whitewashing, you get found out. You always get found out. And in a way, you can kind of try and reposition yourself as this value-based brand. But it's never really sustainable if it's not driven from your process. And I think, you know, I can think of so many examples, both when it comes to sustainability, when it comes to diversity and race. All of these brands, they try and create these kind of shiny advertising campaigns to show how anti-racist they are, for example. And then they always manage to achieve a monumental fail because they don't have people in the room who represent those lived experiences and perspectives. So I think that, you know, I don't feel threatened by big brands trying to talk the talk of the work that brands like us really do, because I think you can tell the difference and eventually it comes out. So I hope that as consumers become much more educated, and that is the really profound change, I think that the appreciation among consumers, the demand, I think actually I have to say this period has been really healthy in that respect, because people have become much more intentional about the ways in which they consume and dispose of things. And I think we've all, and I speak for myself, you know, I don't want to sound preachy, we have all taken a pause and wondered why we have so much stuff. I mean, I look at my wardrobe and I think, where would I wear this stuff to? You know, I don't go out anymore. I mean, obviously, and hopefully that's not forever, but it does make you reflect on the kind of rate of your consumption and the idea that you constantly need new things. And I think that's really good for a brand like us, because you invest in our pieces because it's something that you care about. And that's hopefully something that you will keep for a long time and find different ways of wearing over, you know, over the course of different seasons and different trends.
So on consumers, if you were to sort of do a kind of checklist for the aspirant ethical consumer, What steps do you think individuals can take to support meaningful, positive change in the fashion industry, both positively, but also perhaps to kind of call out the worst offenders and put pressure on brands which engage in harmful, you know, either labor or environmental practices?
I think that it's really important to call out those brands, and that it's getting easier to do it. So, I mean, brands rely on influencers now, so that they're, you know, it's becoming more and more, in a way, democratized, the people that you can access. So I would really encourage people to put pressure on influencers who support brands with unethical and unsustainable practices so that they don't support them. I would use social media in the way that has just been phenomenally successful. I mean, I'm a journalist as well, and I look at the ways in which we've had Stop Spreading Hate, all these campaigns to stop advertisers backing sections of the press that promote racism or promote climate change denial. There are so many ways now of creating that pressure. And I think that there are micro groups on social media platforms. Look at Black Twitter. You know, Black people have been able to kind of weaponize social media in favor of their causes they support. And that, I think that's great, because it allows us to amplify voices that in the past have always been systematically denied a space. So I think it is really important as consumers, don't let brands get away with stuff. Don't let them get away with just trying to rebrand themselves by using a celebrity or an influencer or some new hashtag. And I can think of lots of examples where people have very swiftly and pretty devastatingly called that out. And that's what we need to do. And just as a consumer, if you might not know about the practices behind a brand that you support, but, you know, look at where the clothing is manufactured, see what standards, what global or local standards they've signed up to. Look at press reports. There's a lot of really powerful investigative journalism has really over the last 10 years become a significant field of investigating the practices in fashion. So, but do your research, think about what you're wearing, because what I learned when I made my transition from a print journalist to a TV journalist is something that actually applies to everyone, that through the clothes you wear, you are marketing brands. You are supporting them, you are spreading them, you're promoting them, you're using yourself to promote something. And in the same way as you would think twice about supporting a politician or a party that is not in favor of the things that you value, you should think about the clothes you wear, the accessories, the shoes, and challenge what goes on behind them. And we all are responsible for that. No one can get out of that responsibility.
So I've just finished reading your terrific article for the September edition of British Vogue, and you know, a clarion call around race, around equality, around activism, mixed, you know, with your kind of trademark both passion and righteous anger. So, and I think it's I commend anybody to go and read the article and get the edition. But the fashion media has seen a really significant shift in recent years, where previously excluded individuals and groups have now reached real, authentic positions of power and influence, you know, embodied by Edward Enerfall, who the editor of British Vogue. Do you think this is, in fact, leading to a transformation of the fashion industry via the media and from within?
I'm super excited about Edward Enerfall being the editor of Vogue, as I'm sure you can see. I think what he's done with this September issue is genuinely historic, and I was so humbled to be part of it, to give over the September issue to activism, to activists from all generations, different abilities, sexual orientations, race. I mean, it was just, and it wasn't tokenistic diversity. It was what happens when somebody genuinely moves in a way that engages them with activists from a genuinely diverse range of backgrounds. And that's the product that you get, this storytelling that is inclusive, not because it's trying to be inclusive, but just because it includes people. And I think that was really profound. I mean, just to have a man on the cover of the September issue, I think it's the first time it's happened, to have a Black man shoot the September issue, which Miss Anne Harriman, the British photographer, did, that's a first. I've never written the cover of a September issue, so that was a first for me. It was just an amazing experience, and I was really humbled to be able to really write from my heart about the Black Lives Matter movement and what I think it means for our generation, for the future. It was a very profound thing for me to do, so that was really important. I think it has to make a difference having people in positions of leadership like Edward, because he is relentlessly giving a platform to voices for change, and he is also using images in a way that absolutely subverts some of the norms around beauty, around body image, around ableism. I mean, he's really making it normal to pick up Vogue and see yourself reflected there, which I have to say in my lifetime has not been my predominant experience with any large fashion magazine, let alone Vogue. So that has to cause change. I think that I'm still very critical of the fashion industry. I'm not seeing the speed of change that I would expect. I'm not seeing a genuine, deep-rooted attempt to start kind of starting from a clean slate in a way, in terms of the value chain, in terms of the processes, the manufacturing, the marketing, the product sourcing, even the designs, and kind of respecting the cultural traditions of ideas. I'm just not seeing the kind of root and branch change that I really think is needed. And I think it's probably unrealistic to expect editors of magazines to be able to change that on their own. And I think if they were able to, we would have seen it reflected more in the brands by now. So I think that we should all be critical of that. And, you know, whether you choose sustainability or whether you choose to look at it on race, and I wouldn't present these things as binaries either. They're all interconnected and related. The fashion world really needs to change. I think that there are so many pressures at the moment as well. I mean, a lot of brands have really suffered during this period. But I think history tells us that when you go through periods of economic hardship, that's obviously very distressing for industries like fashion, but it's also an opportunity to kind of go back to the drawing board and question practices and in a way start again. And I think that's literally what we need right now.
So Afua, there'll be a bunch of people listening to this podcast who are either in the fortunate position to be able to be investors or deploy capital or support ethical fashion brands, or be those people who are insane enough to become an entrepreneur to want to set one up. And I'd love you to kind of just give almost just off the cuff nuggets of wisdom on what it takes to set up a successful ethical fashion brand, like how to make it work.
I think the first thing is to say, which you alluded to, Paul, don't do this if you think it's going to make you rich. Anyone who's looking to become rich, just step away from ethical fashion, because that is not why we do this. And, you know, the thing about fashion is I think people see it. Obviously, it's beautiful. It's worn by glamorous people. It makes everyone look glamorous. It's kind of models and fashion shows and editors and magazines. And it looks very glossy. The reality is so different. The reality is hard grind. You need to be somebody who is so passionate about this that you are willing to live with it, make it a huge part of your life. You need to, Phyllis really does the lion's share of kind of managing our production, and she travels to Ghana frequently. She is there on the factory floor. She's picking up the phone from our employees when they've got a problem. She is coordinating everything. And, you know, we have great people working for us, but there is no substitute for being personally and deeply invested in your products, in your people, in your process. It's a real whole life commitment. So you have to have that sense of destiny almost. I know that sounds a bit strong, but I think if you didn't feel that this is what you're meant to do, what you were put on earth to do, it might be hard at times to persuade yourself that you should give over such a huge amount of your energy and waking time to it. So I think you do need that kind of love and passion and energy to do this. But the rewards are also remarkable, and ethical brands can be very successful. And I think the key there is really how to scale up. And I think that With ethical brands, that's harder because you want to be able to grow in a way that preserves the integrity of your brand, and your brand is based in values. You still want to have that connection to the people you work with. You still want to be able to vet and ensure the quality and the ethics of every material in your process. And that's harder the bigger a scale you're working to. So I think that has to be done extremely carefully. And there again, there's a kind of wisdom that you need not to just respond to demand and kind of grow because the demand is there. You have to grow because you're ready and you have a plan and you know how to do it sustainably. And I think just having the discipline and the restraint sometimes to know that you can't put profit ahead of your values, you have to do things in a certain way, it takes a certain kind of character. And I'm saying this, I've learned this mainly from Phyllis rather than from myself, because she is that person and I've learned a lot from her. I think also marketing is really important for ethical brands. Like, as you said from the beginning, you need to be able to tell that story. You need to bring people with you on your journey. And we're really fortunate in the sense that I kind of have a platform for marketing our brands. You can see I wear them all the time. I'm constantly wearing them, constantly talking about them to anyone who'll listen. People I come into contact with find themselves wearing our things because I give our clothes to them and get them to wear them. So I think that if you have a plan as to how you can build a presence and a following, because it is quite hard for a lot of brands to break through on social media, to get influencers to wear their clothes, to get the press to tell stories about their clothes. So I think we've benefited from having that from the beginning in our minds, rather than as an add-on. Once you've kind of made everything, then worry about who's going to wear it. You have to, from inception, be thinking about your plan, because that's how it is now. You know, that's a huge part of the way we work. And as marketing has in a way become more democratized and horizontal on social media, which I think can be great for small brands, it's also become more complicated. You know, it's not like if you get a big splash in a weekend newspaper magazine, you're sorted. That's not it anymore. You've got to be so much more innovative and just forward thinking than that. So if you've got that kind of way of thinking, you already get social media, you're disruptive in the way you imagine publicizing things and telling stories, then that's a strength that could really play to you if you're thinking about an ethical brand.
Let me reflect back for our listeners. One of the things that I've seen in successful ethical brands is they always have a duality. They have a person who is a, dare I say, an afwa, who is a marketer, a storyteller, an inspirational figure. And then they have a person who, dare I say, is a Phyllis, who is a technician, an engineer, a keep the trains running on time. And those are very different people with very different skills. And if you have one without the other in any direction, it fails. It's the amalgam of those two skill sets which are absolutely necessary to a brand.
I think you're right. And also just to say, you know, we found each other kind of halfway through. So I think if you're the technician and you start the brand, it doesn't mean that you can't then find somebody who can be more like me as your partner. And, you know, I think it's just being open-minded about how you do that, but it has to be organic. You can't recruit someone to do that. It has to be somebody who cares as deeply about the brand as you do. And that's why Phyllis and I work so well. I think we've shared this passion. It goes to the root of who we are, but we're also, as you kind of said, very complementary characters. We move in totally different spaces. I could not do what she does, and she would not like to do what I do. So that works.
I'm going to ask you a kind of final question about sustainable fashion and elitism. Because it's hard, because it's difficult, because our supply chains are difficult to scale and to mass produce, it's almost always a little more expensive, or in some cases, a lot more expensive than a kind of traditional high street brand, many of which are cheap because they rely on deeply exploitative labor practices. So let's put that in parentheses. But it seems to me the next chapter in the evolution of ethical fashion has got to be to kind of democratize it. And I wonder just your thoughts on the one hand, guarding against elitism in this very important space. On the other hand, democratizing the ethics of the fashion industry so that it's available to a broader and wider group of consumers. A hard challenge, but your thoughts.
Yeah, you're right. I just want to say, you know, because I've been nice and I'll just say something critical. I think people find money for expensive brands when they want to. And, you know, it's, I've noticed this over the years, that they will invest a certain amount that's maybe, you know, even kind of disproportionate to their income in brands that don't have these values. But when it comes, and we experience this, when it comes to things made on the African continent, for example, we still struggle sometimes with this perception that if it's made in Africa, it should be cheap, you know, that it should be budget. And so that storytelling is very important. And that's not just about our clothes. That's, for me, a kind of challenging colonialism, you know, this idea that we make the highest quality, handmade, made to order, ethical, beautiful pieces that can rival the brands that people pay hundreds of pounds or dollars for in Europe. And the fact that they're made on the African continent doesn't devalue them. If anything, it makes them more special and more meaningful. So I think that people also need to democratize the way they think about fashion and to understand that you should be willing to invest in something from an African country in the same way you would an Italian or a French or a British brand. But that doesn't negate your really important point, which is kind of democratizing it and also the, you know, challenging the elitism. And I've suffered from that myself, just because of the perception that fashion is for a certain kind of person. And that person, you know, when I was growing up, was white, rich, thin, and all these other things that I felt very excluded from, you know. And I'm someone who grew up in a position of kind of material privilege. So if you also are not from a high income background or you don't have those resources, then ethical fashion should be for you. And that is a challenge. I mean, it's partly an economic challenge, because the costs of making things this way are higher. And I think that, again, we've never sought to compete with cheap fast fashion. We can't compete with it, and we don't want to, you know, because we don't believe that's how fashion should be. But I would also like these perceptions that ethical fashion is this kind of like luxury for ladies who lunch, which I think unfortunately still plagues the whole sector. I think that we really need to change that. And that also comes with who is entering the space, you know, who is actually self-identifying as ethical brands. And I think we need to democratize the space and the designers, because ultimately fashion brands are people. People follow people, you know, they follow the story and they follow the people behind the brand. And if consumers see someone they relate to who shares their values and their story making ethical fashion, they'll buy that fashion. And I think sometimes we underestimate how much people buy into a person or a story behind the clothes. And that's something that we try really strongly to communicate, because, you know, between Phyllis and I, we come from backgrounds that many of the people who maybe feel excluded from ethical fashion also come from. And I would like to see more people like us enter this space. And I think that in itself would make a huge difference.
But now a final thought. It's often said that politics is downstream from culture. And that what happens in the cultural realm disproportionately, and in some ways in a kind of invisible way, shapes, contours, and influences the political realm. And therefore, having Edward choose to do what he's done with Vogue, having you write the cover story, having a plethora of fashion brands do ethical, ethical products which are sensitive to the environment, sourced on the African continent, interested about their supply chain, does it perhaps prefigure a change in our politics and signal that in fact the world is moving in a direction that those of us who care about equity and sustainability should be encouraged by?
Yeah, I feel ambivalent about this. On the one hand, I'm incredibly energized by the fact that I think a lot of us have just completely given up on our political leaders and don't have even the smallest expectation of finding inspiration or even basic leadership there. And therefore, we look to these cultural figures who are actually really creating that sense of hope, progress, starting to change the way we relate to each other, starting to help us think in new ways about our social contract even as a society. So I think that's inspiring and wonderful. At the same time, as somebody who cares about politics and, you know, as a lawyer, and I care about the constitution and our democracy, I'm very profoundly disturbed by the idea that such huge sections of the population just no longer have basic confidence in the political class. I think that's really worrying and damaging. So I don't think that cultural change is an answer to the failures in our political systems, which are very deep. And I think we'll get deeper with the technological change that we're seeing. You know, complete failure, both of the individual politicians, but also of our processes to respond to the ways in which our society, our jobs and technology are changing. You know, there's no answer to the idea that that half of all our jobs will be automated within our lifetimes. No 5-year or 4-year term in office can solve that problem, even if we have politicians who are thinking that way, which we don't. So I don't think there's a substitute for that. But at the same time, I think I, like so many others, are kind of voting with my feet and following the people who inspire me in the cultural space, and also hoping to be one of those people myself with the work that I do in documentary and film, creative storytelling and fashion. And I think, you know, we're doing what we can to just keep our society moving, showing the best of what we can be. And also, I think so much about a new generation who are being so failed by our politics at the moment. They don't share those values, you know, at all. More than our generation don't share them. And they are looking to see who to follow, who to learn from, who to be inspired by. And I think that, you know, we have a duty to be there for them, but while at the same time never ceasing to challenge the fact that our political and democratic systems are just failing to do the job. So I think these two things come together. And, you know, I hope that our clothes, our fashion can embody the spirit of protest as much as they do the aesthetics and the culture and the heritage of the African continent that we draw so much from.
A perfect note on which to end. Emerging from the height of the coronavirus pandemic and still the legacy of it to endure for many years to come, being able to have a conversation with a person who walks the walk is a source of inspiration to so many, and who charts and exemplifies how to lead a sustainable and decent life. It's been a pleasure as always. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Really good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on Coutts and their recommendations for a sustainable lifestyle, please visit coutts.com/conduitconversations. For more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.